Astonishing Legends Network.
Listen to the Astonishing Junk Drawer exclusively at patreon.com/astonishinglegends.
We are back. Forrest, say hello to everybody. Please welcome Mr. Ryan Mangini to the stage.
I saw an apparition at our ranch growing up, and I see this black being, like, blacker than the night itself.
Sure. Did you feel like under the influence of anything?
I felt like I was being attacked.
Nobody came out. Nobody else. No neighbor saw that.
It's almost like people want to believe that they're entangled.
Everything's attracted to the light. Even the darkness is attracted to the light. They want to see what's going on.
If you are feeling suicidal, thinking about hurting yourself, or are concerned that someone you know may be in danger of hurting himself or herself, call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-TALK. 1-800-273-8255. It is available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and is staffed by certified crisis response professionals. Astonishing Legends would like to thank Squarespace, Mint Mobile, our contributors at patreon.com, and you, our listeners, for making tonight's show possible.
On a cold December day in 2015, a cyclist made an eerie discovery on a picturesque hiking and biking path near Dovestone Reservoir in Greater Manchester, England. It was the dead body of a man who appeared to be in his late 60s, and it was perfectly aligned with a steep slope but also parallel to the path. His arms crossed over his chest as if placed that way. It was cold and rainy, yet the body was dressed in ordinary clothes. A jacket, corduroy trousers, and slip-on shoes. Ill-prepared for either the weather or a hike. When police arrived, they found no ID, no wallet, not even a set of keys. All the man had on him was 130 British pounds in cash, train tickets, and a small medical container labeled thyroxine, a thyroid medication. The tickets traced his journey from Ealing Broadway in West London to Manchester, but beyond that, nothing. He bought his tickets with cash and, upon arriving, made his way to a pub in Greenfield, where he asked for directions to the top of the mountain. By next morning, he was dead. Initial assumptions about a heart attack gave way to a more complex mystery, as the man had no identification on him, no wallet, keys, or phone, and the cause of death was not what anyone expected. Strychnine poisoning. Strychnine is an antiquated way to kill someone these days. It's thought that wine laced with strychnine is what killed Alexander the Great, and readers of Agatha Christie will no doubt recognize it as a go-to, along with the author's old standbys of cyanide and arsenic. It's an exceptionally painful way to die. If someone gave it to the victim, were they sending a message? And if it was self-administered, who would choose such a painful way to die? The strychnine was found inside the thyroxine container. The container also had some writing in Urdu on the label, a language primarily used in Southeast Asia. Adding to that geographical mystery, the victim had a titanium plate in his leg that originated in Pakistan. Pakistan is one of the few countries where, in 2015, you could still legally purchase strychnine for pest control, and Urdu is also an official language there, along with English. In the United States, when an unidentified corpse is found, it is often given the name John or Jane Doe. In this instance in England, the mortuary staff decided to name the body on the moor Neil Dovestone. Neil just seemed right to them, and Dovestone was a nod to the reservoir he was found near. This case has numerous parallels to one of our most popular series, The Somerton Man. Who was Neil Dovestone?
Welcome back to Astonishing Legends. I'm Scott Philbrook, and this is Forrest Burgess.
To that providence, my sons, I hereby commend you, and I counsel you by way of caution to forbear from crossing the moor in those dark hours when the powers of evil are exalted. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
Join us tonight for part one of our two-part series about the mystery of the body on the moor.
And we're back.
That we are, folks. This is a fun series. We'll encourage you not to look it up if you want to avoid spoilers. We'll have part two next week, so you don't have to wait a week in the middle before that comes up, so you won't have long there.
Yeah, we do think about that, having to take a break between parts, so I'm glad this worked out. Before we start tonight, we wanted to acknowledge a few quick corrections that our last guest, Kathleen Martin, asked us to make about Betty and Barney Hill's case.
Yeah, she wanted us to correct the fact that we had said that Betty remembered a grotesque appearance of the aliens from her dreams, but it wasn't from her dreams. It was from her hypnotic recall. Right. In her dreams, they looked like what she called cadets with large noses.
Yeah, and Kathleen added that Betty and Barney were on US Highway 3 during their UFO encounter, and they regained full consciousness near Ashland and began talking again near Northfield. The craft swooped down at approximately midnight about a mile south of Indian Head on Route 3. And this is where the craft hovered beside the road, and then it moved across the road to the close encounter field. And this is when Barney observed the entities who were, quote, somehow not human, end quote.
Yes, we wanted to make those corrections. Kathleen, thanks for sending those in. One other quick but very important note. Apple is making Patreon add a 30% charge for new members who join through their app after November of this year, 2024. If Patreon doesn't comply, they'll be kicked out of the App Store.
So, if you sign up through the Patreon app, you'll pay more than if you sign up on the web or on an Android device. So, just to be clear, we're not raising our Patreon prices. Those extra charges go straight to Apple, not to us or Patreon.
Exactly. This fee is just for having the app in the Apple Store, and we're not thrilled about it. So, if you're thinking of joining, you haven't joined yet, we recommend doing it on the web or with an Android device.
If you're already a patron, this doesn't affect you at all. It's only for new members who want access to ad-free episodes and our extra content.
Yep, current patrons are all set, but if you want to become a new patron, avoid the extra Apple fee by signing up on the web through a browser or an Android device.
All righty, folks. Well, we've got a great show for you tonight, so let's dive in here.
Well, this is one of those cases that I remember when it happened. The show was already on the air.
That's right.
People were sending us emails and we had, well, who is this guy? Asking us to cover it. And they were sending those for a couple of years.
Yeah.
And we were just doing the Somerton Mans, and it seemed so similar. And we're like, we're moving. We got to go do a UFO or a cryptid somewhere or a haunted house or something like that. And we never came back to it.
You know, there's not that many mysterious missing persons who turn up later or mysterious unknown body cases, but there's a good handful of them. I could think of the Isdal woman. That's another one that was wildly popularly suggested to us, and we thought about covering it. Yeah, we want to give some space. I think 6 or 7 years is a good enough space of time between missing person cases. Like,
yes.
The other one was the Great Mull Air Mystery was another one that, and this is what I like about these kinds of stories, that people say, well, just wrap this all up. It's like, well, not quite. What about this?
Right.
Same thing with Zygmunt Adamski. It's like, well, that can fell on his head. Well, what about this? And it's like, well, okay, that's hard to explain. We're not going to talk about that. So this case is just enough strange to it to keep it spicy.
It somewhat reminds me of the Lady of the Dunes, who was the murder victim from 1974. And they just in 2022, they figured out who she was, which was interesting. But it took a long time to get there.
Yeah.
But this case is very intriguing. And there's a lot of questions about it that I still have to this day. Mm. So we explained a little bit about it in the cold open that Forrest shared with you guys at the top of the show. Let's get more granular on the detail of where this took place. The Dovestone Reservoir is the main location that people talk about when they talk about this case. Mm. Now, that reservoir is part of four reservoirs that are pretty close together there, and they're in an area called the Peak District National Park. Now, this is a gorgeous area based on our research. Haven't been there in person, but it looks amazing. And the reservoirs are here because Manchester needed water. And Manchester's pretty big, and it's been bustling for over 100 years. So it first needed more water than was readily available 130 years ago. Now, the city was booming because of the Industrial Revolution, and they needed to figure out a way to get safe, reliable water to the residents. Naturally, the planners looked toward the Pennines, those hills that soak up most of northern England's rain.
Right, and I'd always heard that the second largest city in England is a toss-up. It's disputed between Birmingham and Manchester. So they just give you a size of the needs of Manchester as a city, whether it's the second largest city or the second city of England. It's a large city. It's a large area. It needs their water. The Pennines are a range of hills and mountains that run through the north of England. And they're often referred to as, quote, the backbone of England. While they don't directly pass through Manchester itself, they are nearby, and they form a natural upland barrier separating northwest England from Yorkshire in the east. And the Pennines stretch from the Peak District in the south up near Manchester and then up to the Scottish border.
Yeah, and they're known for their moorlands, rolling hills and valleys, as well as for being a significant source of rivers and water reservoirs for surrounding areas, including Manchester. Now, the city of Manchester relies on water collected from the Pennines, stored in reservoirs like the one at the center of tonight's legend, Dovestone, as well as others to supply drinking water to its population. They also offer opportunities for outdoor activities like hiking, walking, and cycling for people living in or visiting Manchester.
Yeah, it's a lovely spot of water in the at the bottom of one of the moors there, one of the little valleys. When you see a picture of it, it looks terrific to hike. It's gorgeous, except for when there's really inclement weather, which I think is a lot of the time, especially in this case here in December, not what you want to be strolling around in without the proper gear.
But as far
as water is concerned, to meet that demand, they built their first reservoir, Yeoman Hay. Am I saying that right? Did you? That's what
yes,
I got.
You are.
Yeoman Hay. Okay, yeah. In 1880, that happened. Then Greenfield Reservoir followed in 1902. Then after that, they added the Chew Reservoir in 1912. And about that time, it was the highest in Britain, sitting at around 1,600 feet above sea level, which is good. That's, you want the water high up, then let gravity do the work. We may scoff at that here in the U.S. with their that being high up. But what's your altitude, Scott, there in Denver, the Mile High City?
5,280 right. feet. That's what they say.
Oh, really?
It's probably a gimmick.
Well, you get what you deal with. But what about the Dovestone Reservoir as a body itself?
Yeah, that one came along a lot later. It wasn't completed until 1967. It's the largest of the four. But going back to the first one, Yeoman Hay, which was in the 1800s, there was a bit of concern from the local mill owners when they were planning that because they were worried they were going to lose the water they needed for their mills. So a tunnel was built from Birch and Clough to the Ashway Gap to make sure water still flowed into Greenfield Brook for the mills to use.
And today, these four reservoirs supply drinking water to Oldham and the communities in the Tame Valley. And they're run by United Utilities, which provides water to nearly 3 million homes in Northwest England.
And while these reservoirs are important for supplying water, they've also become spots for recreation. You can't swim there because of dangerous undercurrents from the deep water and outlet pipes, but sailing and windsurfing are pretty popular, especially on Dovestone Reservoir. They even host regular races, and when I came across all this in our research, as a former windsurfer, back when it was still in vogue, my first thought was, if swimming isn't okay, not positive I want to windsurf there, no one wants to be sucked into a vortex.
Well, if you're too paranoid to windsurf, there are tons of land activities too, and then of course, there's hiking and biking, which is central to tonight's legend. Also, our gentleman Neil here didn't go out of his way to not be discovered, so he's...
That's true.
Right on the trail, so it's not like he wanted to go deep into the moors or crawl under a thicket. The idea, though, is that in this location, somebody at some point was going to walk or hike by or bike by.
That's right.
And so,
that's right.
You know, very close to the trail and resting comfortably with his head pointed up the hill. So on the other hand, I could, here in the U.S., I could see a lot of people like, well, I thought he was taking a nap, so I just left him there. And then he's finally discovered 2 weeks later.
Well, in addition to the walkway, some of it paved, some of it unpaved, scrambling on rocks, this sort of thing, there are numerous paths and bridleways that wind through the surrounding moors. One of the most notable is the Oldham Way, a 40-mile circular walking route around Oldham. Part of it runs across the hillside near Dovestone, following an old steam tramway that was built over 100 years ago when they were constructing the Chew Reservoir.
Well, it's kind of wild to think that something built so long ago to meet a purely industrial need is now a place where people come to relax and race, explore, hike around. But it turns out this area has an incredibly dark past as well. And not only that, concentrated pretty close together. That's also kind of coincidentally weird. But I will say on that note, though, it's also kind of not weird. That's kind of the trend more so recently nowadays where you'll see like an old steam plant being turned into a wedding venue.
Yes.
Tracks to trails where they'll rip out old industrial railroad tracks and make those bike paths and biking trails. And it's lovely.
It looks amazing. It's apparently some place that people make a pilgrimage to hike. And there's all kinds of boating on the reservoir itself. There's a sailing club down there. It looks like an amazing place. Mm-hmm. And it's located just above the town of Greenfield in Greater Manchester, England. And it rests on a part of what they call Saddlebrook Moor. You can hike or bike to all of these areas from Dovestone. And Greater Manchester, which is right next to it, had a lot of people in it as of 2022. This was 3 million residents. So you can imagine how many people are coming out of there and going over to check this place out. It's about 12 miles slightly northeast of the center of Manchester. Mm-hmm. let's talk about how the body on the moor was discovered. Owing to the fact that this is a park system and folks are going in there all the time to do hiking and biking, there's a guy in there biking who bikes in there regularly. Mm-hmm. His name was Stuart Crowther. Stuart found the body while he was riding through there. It was on the Chew Track Trail, which is a Chew, that's C-H-E-W. It's named for a stream that starts at a higher elevation there and comes down and actually creates that valley.
Right. There's some unknown etymology about the name Chew.
Yeah, they're not really sure where it came from. They trace it back to two or three different things, different languages and origins. But like a lot of stuff across the pond from us, which is where everything's a lot older, they're not really sure why it's called
Chew. It may or may not be as colorful as scape or swamp, the etymology.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, you know, this one, I love old English names for towns here because there's usually some great lore to it. But this one's kind of unknown. It's just kind of a fun, it is chew like you chew food.
Hi, my name is Rhiannon Bear, and when I'm not expelling the forces of darkness, I'm listening to Astonishing Legends. Let's get back to the show.
Coming back to the three reservoirs that are very close together, they're actually connected right there. There is Dovestone, which is the one that's often mentioned with regard to this case. And then there's Yeoman Hay, which is next to it. And then above that is the Greenfield Reservoir, which is also the name of the town down at the bottom of Dovestone. To the southeast, a little bit further over, is the Chew Reservoir, named for the Chew Valley. Now, there's a trail that goes around all four of these reservoirs. And I want to thank our friend Gled, who's been on the show before and lives over there, for doing a little research on this and sending me the All Trails map. I actually have an All Trails membership, so that was great. Just pulled it right up. It's really cool because you can see the topography and what they recommend and what people say about hiking the trail. It's a tough trail, actually. It's not very easy if you were to do the whole thing. It has a total elevation gain of 1,450 feet. So imagine walking the steps in a 14-story building, because that's what you'd have to do to hike it. But some of those steps would be paved and some would be rocky, and you would have to do what All Trails calls scrambling across rocks, which is something Patty is super good at. I'm not so great anymore, but I did do that in my youth. So let's talk about the body itself. This gentleman was a little over 6 feet tall. He was white or Caucasian. He had blue eyes and a very large nose that appeared that at some point it might have been broken. And while he was laying there on the side of the path, he looked like he was just resting, which is something that's very interesting. When rescuers came up, they thought, well, maybe this guy was coming down or climbing up and he had a heart attack and he just went over and laid down.
Right.
Other investigators thought, well, maybe this was a suicide. That's the first thing they thought, but it wasn't clear how he might have died. One of the investigators said, well, it looks to me like when he sat down, he just laid back and started to maybe look up at the sky, and then he just passed away. But when they checked the body, they could find no identification of any kind. There was nothing on him that would say who he was. There was just 130 British pounds, all in $10 notes, in his wallet, and there were some train tickets and a small container of medicine. So there were folks that had seen this gentleman the day before, and the last spot that he had a conversation with somebody was at the Clarence Pub, and that was in the town of Greenfield, which is down below the moor and below the reservoir and these trails. And he had gone in there at 2 p.m. on December 11th, 2015. And a lot of hikers stop in at this pub. It's kind of that last spot that people will come to, I'm going to go in there. They're going to tell me how to get over to the trailhead or if I want to hike up there. So they're used to meeting people who come in and say, hey, how do I get up there? So at 2 p.m., he goes in there and he asks the landlord for the pub, how do I get to the top of the mountain? That's what he was interested in. Well, at this time of year in December, northwestern England, sunset was at 3:49. That's like just under 2 hours from when he's walking in asking about getting to the top of the mountain. That's going to have full, like, pitch black darkness, depending on what the moon's doing, by 6 p.m. So he didn't have a lot of time. And the landlord was like, you're not going to make it today. You're not going to be able to make it up and get back down before it's dark. And he said, thank you very much. Can you just tell me again, how do I get to the top of the mountain? So the landlord, whose name was Melvin Robinson, says, this is what he told the BBC anyway, I also noticed that he was not dressed for a hike. He didn't have the right kind of weather on. He said it wasn't raining, but it was very cold and it looked like it was going to rain. And it was dark out, already getting dark because it was cloudy.
And he was like, this guy wasn't set for that. He said that most of the time when people came in there, they would have backpacks, they'd have water with them and hiking shoes and all that kind of stuff. This guy, none of that. Because as we said, parts of this trail are very technical, and especially if you're trying to get all the way up to the higher elevations there.
Well, according to the BBC, it was investigated by Detective Thomas Coleman at the time. And here are some things to note about bodies being found. Not all bodies have ID on them, but usually you can match that person with a missing persons report. But at that time, there were no reports matching the description of this man. And as I said in the cold open, he did have 130 British pounds on him. And this was all in 10-pound notes. So it wasn't like he just had a few bucks or spent it all down. And it wasn't like he had cashed out his entire bank account. It was just enough traveling around money. So that's an interesting clue. The other thing he had on him were train tickets, just like the Somerton man. And that showed that he took the train from West London to Central London a little after 9 a.m. But by 10 a.m., he was at Euston Station, which is the main train station for getting from London to the West Midlands, Northwest England, North Wales, and Scotland. And along the way, stop off in Manchester. And his tickets were round trip. Okay, so another clue, why spend the extra money?
Why the round trip ticket? What does that tell us? Well, maybe it tells us, he was planning to come back.
Perhaps, but I want people to keep in mind as we go along here that all the things that seem to make sense, what have we learned, people, that any of these stories, the rationale of things sometimes often don't add up and like, well, that would have happened because he did this. Or she did this, and that doesn't make any logical sense. It's like, you got to throw that out the window a little bit because there are things that people do. The fact that it is a round-trip ticket. Well, Scott and I talked about this. People who buy a plane ticket now, and instead of taking the round trip, it's cheaper to just buy the round trip and get off and not take that the second
hidden
leg coming
city,
back.
Or whatever you do.
What do you call that? Yeah.
Oh, no, the hidden city is when your plane stops somewhere and you get off.
You get which they don't appreciate that.
But they don't like it when you fake the round trip as well. Yeah.
Right. It's an empty seat on the plane. But people will do that because like, well, it was just cheaper than buying a one-way ticket or whatever. So, you know, things that don't make sense often will to that person at that time. So keep that in mind.
But important point here, the round trip ticket was only £1 more.
That's a good point. Yes. Again, I hate to speculate at this point, like the motivations for somebody, especially someone suspected of foul play, ends up in a mysterious circumstance, could be murdered, could be suicide, who knows yet?
Right.
You're just kind of guessing even with clues. And we're still doing that with the Somerton man, even though there are strong indications of who he might be now.
Well, he paid cash for everything. And as we said, at 10 a.m., he departed Euston, and then he's in Manchester on CCTV just a little afternoon that same day, so about 2 hours later.
Right.
Cameras again catch him walking out of the station in central Manchester around 1 o'clock. 1 hour later, he walks into the Clarence Pub in Greenfield and asks Melvin, as we said, directions to the top of the mountain. The police don't know how he got from Manchester to Greenfield during that hour. Now, that's a little over 12 miles. According to Google, it would take you 35 minutes or so to drive there. And if he were to walk that, it would have taken 4.5 hours. Right. So it doesn't seem like he walked it. He made it in an hour. So how did he get there? Who knows? I don't know. 2015.
Right. If he hitchhiked, you would think somebody...
Some kind of bus thing? Well, I'm not sure.
Perhaps. Somebody gave him a ride, you would think that that person would have come forward after, but then you never know either. He could have gotten a ride, hitchhiked that distance, and that person who gave the ride never came forward or saw that or put it together that that man ended up dead in a mysterious circumstance and was unidentified. So again, more speculation. But he leaves the Clarence Pub just after 2 p.m., so they know that. And the Dovestone Reservoir also contains a bird sanctuary area that the RSPB, or Royal Society for the Protection of Birds, established just 5 years prior to the incident. So pretty new. And about 2 hours after Neil Dovestone, again, that's his alias, his John Doe, after Neil leaves the Clarence, he passed two members of this birding protection club here, the RSPB, and that time was around 4 p.m. So figure this, the sun had set 10 minutes prior, it's now dark, and he was still heading up the trail, which would catch people's attention.
Speaking of which, I want to go back to something that we haven't done since the early years of the show. I'm just going to take a little quick tangent here. One of our patented tangents, the old-timey ones. And I will recall a time when me and my close friend Jerry, who was a guest on the show some time ago for the episode What's Gotten Into You, which was about a bug.
Which was a June bug that had gotten into him. Yeah,
June bug that got into him. Some time ago, 18 years or something like that, he and I went to the Grand Canyon together. We were all living in LA at the time. And we drove from Los Angeles to the Grand Canyon over Thanksgiving because my wife was visiting friends in the Northeast. And we were like, hey, let's go to this trip. We'll go on a hike. And we went there and we hiked down this trail into the Grand Canyon, not the Bright Angel Trail, a different one whose name escapes me now. I have it on a map, but it was one of the less traveled ones. And our goal was to just go far enough to lay eyes on the Colorado River and get back out in one day. And we're like, can we do that? And we felt like we could. We were young and younger, and we're going to do that. So we got up there and we hiked down this trail. We're descending. It's November, mind you. So it's actually a little cool.
Yeah.
Descending down there. And there's this sign that says day hike limit. They might not have this over at the Dovestone Reservoir on the Chew Track or the path that Neil Dovestone was found. Okay. But that's where you're supposed to turn around if you want to get back out in one day. And we didn't do that. We were like, no, it's got to just be down there. And we kept going and we went down past the day hike limit and we kept hiking until we were able to stop and we could see the Colorado River and it was awesome. But then it was time to leave and the sun was setting. And it was November, which meant it was going to get real cold. Right. And we had some supplies, but not much. So we turned around, we started to hike back out and we barely made it out. It was right after dark, and you couldn't drive or park near this trailhead. You had to wait for these trams, and we just barely caught the last one.
Oh, my goodness. How long would have a walk have been had you missed
it? I don't even know what would have happened, but one of the things that did happen is as we were getting close to the top, there was an elderly couple trying to climb out, and we went past them, and the man was resting on a rock, and the wife was standing with him, and they looked like they were in their 70s.
So you just left them there?
No, well, we didn't. There were other people on the trail, and our thing was like, I don't know what to do, and we didn't know them, but we both were like, well, are they going to make it out? And we barely made it out, and when the tram got there, I know we told them that they were down there, and it seems like they said they go down and check on the, you know, they have burrows, these like crazy burrows that are like the Budweiser Clydesdales of burrows, and they go at the end of the day, I think, and they check the trail. That's my tangent. But like, because when I heard this story, I was thinking about, oh, well, that's basically this day hike limit. You're not going to get up there and back in the same day. Yeah. And when you are hiking and you do a lot of hiking and trailing and you go out and you do this kind of stuff, you run into people and you're like, I don't know if they're doing the right thing or if they're going to get out okay. But it's enough of them that there's only so much you can do. It's like, oh, do you need help? Do you need assistance? And if they say no, well, then, you know, you got to leave them alone. Mm. But, there was nothing in the news about people disappearing that day.
Okay.
By the way, we went so far past the day hike limit. For the next 2 days, really, we couldn't walk at all.
Oh.
Our legs were just shot.
That's the thing. Most of the time, you don't hear anything about it because people came out okay. I've had friends that have done unwise things or like an all trails guide or rating was mislabeled. And then it's like, wow, this is much, much harder than the book said.
Oh, sure.
And there's a lot more scrambling, climbing rocks, not just walking. You're on your hands and knees and getting footholds to make it up. And coming back down is even harder. There's that, and then not leaving with enough in your pack for a water. You know, people that aren't that familiar will often misjudge things and overestimate what they can do or overestimate the good conditions when it's going to turn bad. And that's when you get into trouble because things can change in a minute.
Let me just say one other thing.
Yeah.
What we did was stupid, and I want to make that clear. I don't want any of our listeners to like think that that was a good idea because it was dumb and we were lucky that something bad didn't happen to us. So,
but in this case, this is what got people's attention, why they remembered the times that he was there, because again, he had no backpack. He's not dressed for it. He's wearing basically street clothes for a older middle-aged man. And so it seems a little odd. So it catches people's attention and they do remember him, but they still don't know enough to like intervene. So in this case, it's not enough to draw attention, but it was unusual enough for people to take notice. Same thing with him being discovered on Saturday the 12th by the cyclist Stuart Crowther, in that he just said, I think the guy was taking a nap. He seemed very much at peace. This is another thing about the poisoning. He wasn't like found sprawled all over like he was writhing.
Right.
He seemed like he was napping, but again, it's like, well, that's okay, but that's not a great place for a nap. Something's odd about this, which caught Stuart Crowther's attention. So he came upon that scene just before 10:30 a.m. And this would be about 18 and a half hours after he was last seen.
So during the police investigation, the investigating officer went and met with police in London and security personnel at the train stations. They were trying to figure out what path Neil Dovestone, in quotes, took. Through CCTV footage, they were able to trace him across multiple cameras, and that's how they figured out that he had come to Euston Station from a tube station at Ealing, further west of London. Now, notably, Ealing connects the tube to Heathrow. So then they're wondering, what if he flew into England from somewhere else?
Okay, that's possible. There are some international connections, as we hinted at.
They also noted that in reviewing the footage, he walked past one of the entrances he needed to get into one of the train stations, which would indicate to them that he wasn't familiar with the area.
Right.
And this made me think, God, imagine the Somerton Man case if there had been CCTVs everywhere, like there are now in England, especially.
Right.
Yeah. If you could have just gone back. And these days, it seems like it would be a lot harder to have a case like that you couldn't quite figure out. In fact, these days, it's usually like you have the footage,
right,
but you still can't explain it. Like the guy that went into the young man that went into the club somewhere and never came out. And they've like,
oh, yes.
I want to cover that story, but I don't even know. It might not be longer than 10 minutes.
To your point, though, with the CCTV footage, you could have a lot of footage and still have a mystery. But I get your point, though. Could we be a little closer? Well, what's amazing is just in, let's say, 15, 20 years, the progress of police forensic investigation and how far that's come. Don't you always hear on these true crime things like, well, that was 1996 and the DNA analysis wasn't as good as it is now.
And this case was 2015 and they had all the camera footage and they still couldn't figure it out for a very long time. So,
but here's another thing you often hear with many of these cases. And I think this is just how real life is and businesses and how people operate. A lot of those security cameras weren't working at the time.
Yeah. It's one of those things where it's like, well, we put up a camera and it's like, it broke. I don't care. I don't feel like messing with it.
Well, you know, nobody thinks like, that stuff until something happens, and then it's then you wish it was working.
Yeah.
What about his clothes? What do we know about that?
Well, he was wearing some pretty nice clothes. They actually had come from a luxury chain store in the UK known as Marks and Spencer, which most people, anybody that's traveled over there will have heard of. Even I had heard of it.
Ooh.
And I think lately it's actually been a little bit of trouble. I think COVID did a number on it as well. But they're still around. And for that time, that was nice clothes for him to have. And he was also wearing a luxury shoe brand from Sweden. So he was not poorly dressed.
Right.
This is Darren Young from Snipe Hunt. When I'm not working on my own strange podcast, I'm listening to Astonishing Legends. Now back to the show.
Well, let's talk about the method of death. That was the strychnine poisoning. Mm-hmm. The container that he had that was found on him said that it had thyroxine sodium in it. Now, that's a hyperthyroid medication. And a reminder, the container also had writing, and I'm talking about not handwriting, but graphically imprinted Urdu on the label, a language that you might get in Pakistan and other parts of Southeast Asia. Now, thyroxine does not contain strychnine, just to be clear. And strychnine was outlawed in the EU in 2006, so 9 years prior to this. So the victim had to have gotten it somewhere else. Now, as we said earlier, it could still be purchased for pest control use anyway in Pakistan. And so is that a clue?
Well, you want to tell us about strychnine? You got some strychnine facts here, I see.
Yeah, this is from the CDC's website. Let's talk about that a little bit, because this goes to the question of whether or not he was forced to take strychnine or he took it by choice. Mm-hmm. If you're exposed to strychnine, this is straight from the CDC website, the immediate signs and symptoms that would occur for you as someone who had taken it, and this would be within 15 minutes to an hour after ingesting it, would be agitation, apprehension or fear, the ability to be easily startled.
These are all strange, by the way, I find.
Yeah,
restlessness. More emotional responses, yeah.
Yeah. Painful muscle spasms, possibly leading to fever and to kidney and liver injury. Uncontrollable arching of the neck and back, which I think is important, again, considering how he was found.
Right, right.
Rigid arms and legs, jaw tightness, muscle pain and soreness, difficulty breathing, and dark urine. Now, if you're exposed to high doses of strychnine, you may have the following signs and symptoms in the first 15 to 30 minutes. Respiratory failure, possibly leading to death, and or brain death. So, but no matter how you look at this, you take a little, it's not great. You take a lot, it's a really horrible way to go.
And again, it does not speak to how he was found. which was pretty peaceful and not contorted. It's just odd. But yeah, what we do know is that was found in his body. So at some point, he was either forced to take it or had taken it himself. But if he had taken it himself, then he had to have taken it there. He was not transported from a primary location.
Right. He was seen apparently fine. Let's talk about that because that's interesting. Depending on how long it would take for it to work, he must not have taken it or been forced to take it when he was at the Greenfield.
Right.
Like he would have taken it maybe after his hike.
That's a good point. It wasn't slipped to him at the pub.
Right. No, because he was seen 2 hours later. Right,
exactly.
By witnesses. Yeah. So,
well, here are two other things to consider then in our true crime camp here. Did he make it to the top of the mountain as he asked? And was he met there by somebody or did somebody follow him up if there was foul play? And if he asked about the top of the mountain, why didn't he do that there?
Right. Was it a rendezvous?
Well, that's the thing. You would think like, okay, going out with a bang and a writhe, I'm going to do that at the top of the mountain, not kind of halfway down.
Well, let's come back to this thing about Pakistan, which is interesting. So the bottle of the thyroxine sodium was confirmed by GlaxoSmithKline to have been manufactured for the market in Pakistan. Another thing that Neil Dovestone had was a titanium plate in his leg that was bolting his femur together after what had clearly been a serious leg injury that they thought was maybe within the prior 2 years. Right. And the plate was specifically from a company that was in Pakistan.
Right.
And authorities traced it to having only been used in a little over a dozen hospitals, all in Pakistan, and they were using maybe around 500 a year. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing they determined was that it had been installed in an unusual way surgically. So they thought, well, if we can narrow this down, this method of surgery and this particular plate, maybe we can contact these hospitals and figure out exactly where this surgery happened.
Mm-hmm. Well, now let's talk about the area in general, and more specifically, Saddleworth Moor, because this place turns out to have a long history of dark events. And in the articles I was reading, the comments from people, I don't know if anybody really said it had a vibe, but man, do I get that there's a vibe there, even as lovely as it is.
Our friend Gled, who helped us with research on this one and, having been over there, and he actually was, he's retired from Scotland Yard. He was actually involved in searching through CCTV footage for this guy when they were trying to figure out who he was.
Right.
He himself personally, which is pretty interesting. But he did say that it was a spooky area. He implied that a lot had happened there. And that brings us to our next section here. It does have a very grisly past. We're going to approach this chronologically. So set the Wayback Machine for 1832. In the U.S., Andrew Jackson was president, and cholera was just starting to break out in Scotland and England. Charles Darwin was beginning his journey on the HMS Beagle. But in the Saddleworth Moors, something evil was unfolding.
Most folks who live in the UK probably know about the Saddleworth Moor. Well, I guess from those notorious Moors murders, but something else creepy happened there well before those. In the early 19th century, a horrific crime took place that was shrouded in bloody mystery, and unanswered questions. Did I do my American Werewolf in London line yet?
No, not this time around.
Okay, so now the time to saddle you all with that. Yeah. Stay off the moors.
Ah, there you go.
It's good advice. At least stay off this moor, because in a small measure of area, a lot of bad things happened of different varieties.
Right.
Yeah.
Everyone knows about the Moors murders. That's what everyone thinks about. And we'll talk about them in a second. But this preceded them. We're talking about the murder of two men at a pub known as Bill O'Jack's, or the Moorcock, as it was officially called. Yeah, this was in 1832. And the Moorcock was a pub run by an old man named William Bradbury, known locally as Bill. It stood about 2.25 miles from where the body on the moor was found. And just to avoid any confusion here, that's M-O-O-R, Cock, C-O-C-K. Don't send that email to us. Just hold off. Mm. That was its real name. Anyway, Bill Bradbury was 84 years old at the time, in 1832 again. His son, Thomas Bradbury, or Tom, was 46 and a gamekeeper by trade. The pub's name, Bill O'Jacks, which was the unofficial name, came from William, Bill, being the son of a man named Jack. But the name on the building said Moorcock. confusing, we know, but that's how it went.
Right.
The place sat up high above the future home of the first reservoir, the Yeoman Hay Reservoir, which, if you recall from what we said earlier in the show, is one of the three reservoirs that are close together there, with the Dovestone Reservoir being the lowest one. Yeoman Hay is above that, and then you have the Greenfield Reservoir, as in Greenfield Village, down below, where Neil Dovestone last spoke to someone before heading out for his fatal hike. But back in 1832, when this happened, none of those reservoirs existed. Manchester wasn't big enough to need them yet. The Yeoman Hay Reservoir would be the first of the four, but it wouldn't even be built until 48 years after this. So at this time, the moors were just the moors. Also, back in 1832, this area was pretty isolated. This essentially took place at a pub out in the middle of nowhere.
Again, American Werewolf in London. I just imagine it's one of those places you come in during a rainstorm and then everyone turns and looks at you and gives you the stink eye.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
They're probably very friendly there, I'm sure. But
yes,
it's
yes.
The perfect setting for something ominous to happen. And so one of them being on the evening of April 2nd, Tom Bradbury, the 46-year-old son of the 86-year-old proprietor Bill and grandson of this now, well, we would imagine now deceased Jack Bradbury, didn't take the old gentleman's advice from the pub. He was out on the moors. Well, he was a gamekeeper, so that makes sense. And that's someone who oversees areas of land to make sure that there are game animals for people to hunt and if there's lakes and ponds, to fish. Well, Tom now didn't have the best reputation. And in fact, he was known to be kind of an aggressive jerk and nobody seemed to like him. So circling back to the day in question, this would be April 2nd, 1832. Tom was done with his keeping duties for that day. And then he came back to the pub to unwind with his friend, Reuben Platt. Reuben was a regular at the pub, so nothing unusual so far. The two of them decided to take a walk down to Greenfield because Tom had to pick up some groceries, and Reuben was just heading home. And it's a couple miles away and maybe might have taken, I don't know, 30 minutes each way.
Yeah, and so as they're walking down the road, they bump into Bill, Tom's dad. Tom gives him the pub's door key, and they keep going. A little while later, they run into three men resting on the side of the road. One of these guys asks how far it is to Holmfirth. Now, Holmfirth is about 12 miles away, and this was the road from Greenfield to Holmfirth. The pub was along the way there, but that would be a 4 or 5 hour walk. Now, this is where things start to feel off to Tom. The guy's got an Irish accent, which probably isn't that strange, but Tom can't shake a bad feeling. Mm-hmm. He tells Reuben, his buddy who's walking with him, that he's uneasy about those three guys. He's also worried about leaving his dad alone at the pub. So he had an instinct right off the bat, apparently.
Well, always trust that gut instinct, I say. So then after getting those groceries in Greenfield, Tom heads back towards the pub, and that's when things go silent. No one really knows what happened next, or at least not until the next morning.
That's right. The next day, Bill's granddaughter, Amelia, goes over to the pub to grab some yeast, and when she walks in, she is met with a gruesome sight. She sees someone, turns out it was Tom, lying on the floor, drenched in blood. She panics and runs upstairs, only to find her grandfather in an equally horrifying state. He's lying on his bed, covered in blood, barely clinging to life. She freaks out, obviously, and bolts to the nearest house about a half mile away. She tells the man there, named James Whitehead, and he rushes to the pub to see for himself. Then he sends for a surgeon, Mr. Higginbottom, who had to come all the way from Upper Mill, a couple of miles away. So when the surgeon arrives, he's greeted by a scene straight out of a horror story.
No first responding here. It's like second or third or fourth responders. You're just not going to get aid very fast. It's not like calling 999. See, we learned that. 911 over here. Well, by the time anyone gets over there of any authority to help, Tom was still lying on the floor and he's surrounded by blood. His head was a mess of clotted gore. Sorry to get graphic, but that's the reality of it. And it's kind of reminding me of a little bit of Villisca here.
Yes.
And he was barely hanging on, but he's trying to lift himself up. So he's not quite dead yet. And he's only basically just falls back down into the blood. And when the surgeon checked him, Tom was in his final moments. And within a short time, he died from the 16 wounds he had to his head. So it was a very vicious and brutal attack. His skull had been fractured in two places. He was bruised all over. So yeah, very violent, very savage thrashing.
Yeah. And as for Bill, he was in his bedroom upstairs, having somehow dragged himself up there after being attacked. His injuries were just as gruesome. Deep cuts to his head, cut down to the bone, I believe, on his arms, mangled fingers, broken bones. It was clear he had been in a serious struggle. He passed away the next morning, unable to survive the horrific injuries. But before he died, he was heard to have said I can't remember to who, but to an eyewitness, when they said who did this, he said a word like Pats or Pats or Pat. Mm. And there's just been a billion speculative stories about this. I'm sure there's full podcasts out there about this one thing. We're just touching on it tonight as part of the bigger picture, but I would go find those because it's a pretty crazy story. Because some people are like, oh, well, maybe he was trying to name Tom's friend, Reuben Platt. But folks, and Reuben was under suspicion apparently for a while. Right, but then they're like, no, it's a nickname for Irish people. Or they're like, no one knows what it meant and what he said. And then he died. So there you go.
Despite all the carnage, nobody was ever arrested for the murders. And to this day, it's still a mystery, which always makes me wonder. The people who did it, and they know they did it, they, I guess, take that to their grave, and how do they feel about that? I mean, just like you're on your deathbed, and you're just going to, I know I'm not expecting a deathbed confession. I'm just saying it's just what a secret to live with. Or you're a murderous, homicidal maniac, and you don't care.
Yeah.
Well, theories have floated around, and some of them are pretty wild, but nothing concrete has ever been brought to the surface. So this case went cold, and that was pretty much the end of it. And it's kind of mind-boggling. There's no leads. There's no suspects that really stuck to it, and the crime has just kind of faded into the dark history of the Saddleworth Moors. Now, that pub itself was demolished in 1937, and now all that's left is the cellar, which is apparently used by sheep as a shelter. And I wonder if the sheep get any EVPs. I'll bet that place is rife with ghostiness.
Yeah.
Strange ending, really, for a place with a violent episode and a violent past.
Yeah, and the site is marked on maps as Bill O'Jack's Plantation, which is why they tore it down to make room for a plantation. That's why they got rid of the pub, among other things. It's obviously had a grisly past. But the memory of the murders still lingers in the landscape, even though the full story might never be known. It's one of those cases where the mystery is probably going to stay unsolved forever. Everyone involved is long dead. Forrest, why don't you read what's on the gravestone? There's a big, long inscription on this gravestone where Bill and Tom Bradbury are both buried.
Here lie the dreadfully bruised and lacerated bodies of William Bradbury and Thomas, his son, both of Greenfield, who were together savagely murdered in an unusually horrid manner on Monday night, April 2nd, 1832, William being 84 and Thomas being 46 years old. Throughout the land, wherever news is read, intelligence of their sad end has spread. Those now who talk of far-famed Greenfield Hills will think of Bill O'Jacks and Tom O'Bills. Such interest did their tragic end excite that ere they were removed from human sight, thousands on thousands came to see the bloody scene of catastrophe. One house, one business, and one bed, and one most shocking death they had. One funeral came, one inquest passed, and now one grave they had a last.
Very poetic. Right. I just want to point something out that I learned when we were researching this. Bill O'Jacks and Tom O'Bills, the point of that, the reason that, you know, it was the Moorcock pub,
right?
But Bill O'Jacks, it's an old fashioned way of saying Bill, the son of Jack.
Yeah.
So Bill O'Jacks, why they called it that. Oh, and then Tom O'Bills, they died together. So Tom was Bill's son. So Bill O'Jacks and Tom O'Bills is how they refer to it. So this story leaves you with a lot of questions, but not the kind you can answer. It's just one of those stories where the more you dig, the less clear things get. What really happened that night? Who were those three men there? I mean, did they have anything to do it? We don't know that. That would be an assumption. Were they involved, or was it something else entirely? It's just another one of several tragedies at Saddleworth Moor.
Well, exactly. You know, it's one of those stories that just keeps people wondering. There's enough there to keep it alive in memory, at least local memory there. People, inscriptions and stories told in the pub and around the fire, but it's not all enough to bring any closure to that. So that's the first recorded murder mystery in this area, but it's not going to be the last.
No, so here's another dark story from the Saddleworth Moors, but this time it's not murders. It's about a tragic DC-3 plane crash that happened back in August of 1949. So this is over 110 years later after the case we just discussed. And a strange coincidence of synchromysticism, the likes of which we've reported before with on our show. This episode that you're hearing right now is originally posting just 2 days before the 75th anniversary of this plane crash here in 2024.
And yes, we know this is a tangential story to the body in the moor, one that we didn't really know about. We had no knowledge of this before we selected the topic. But here we are mentioning this crash 2 days before its anniversary. But here's another thing. It's one of those stories also. I remember one of the first times that happened is, I think, researching Lake Baikal. I was like, well, this is a very cool geographical feature. Before we really were drilling down or found a niche, it was just kind of a neat geological feature that was cool in itself. And then you start opening up like, wait a minute, silver suited humanoids, 8 feet tall with bubble helmets. I say yes. More, please. The Chinese government having some captured bodies that were in suspended animation. I don't think that's going on here, but the idea is that it starts leading to other weird turns. Like, really, that happened? And it's within, I believe, was it Andy Valentine, the park ranger in the area?
Yes.
From that BBC article was saying, he was the one I first started pointing out all of these things that happened right on that spot. And that's what I was mentioning earlier, trying to allude to, is that he didn't really come out and say it, but like, you could tell that he was saying this place has a vibe and that there's something, maybe there's something going on here. It's kind of a magnet of darkness of sorts. But again, like any magnet of darkness, there's a lot of people, probably most, that just enjoy it and have never felt anything weird. And it's like, no, it's just lovely here to go biking and hiking, never felt anything weird. And on the other hand, you cannot deny the place's history. So again, a horrific crash, a murder so far, and more darkness to come.
So this DC-3 came down in what crash investigators today refer to as a controlled flight into terrain.
Right.
Which means that there wasn't really any emergency or a problem with the aircraft. It was under full control, but a pilot or navigational error led to a collision with the ground. That term didn't exist, or that assessment didn't exist till the 70s. I think Boeing came up with it, but it's a good explanation of what happened. Usually when this happens, the crew and passengers have no idea they're in danger until it's over, which is terrifying. And in this case, the crash happened on a cloud-covered hill at Wimberry Stones near Trevally on Saddleworth Moor, only about 15 miles from their destination at the Manchester Airport. The clouds were bad that day as another plane crashed just 40 miles away that same day, killing all four aboard.
Yeah, I wonder if that would be like Flight 401, where essentially there was a cockpit crew error where I think somebody bumped the autopilot, taking it off autopilot, and the plane was descending so slowly nobody noticed, and that was a controlled flight into terrain.
That's right. Good memory.
Yeah, I just remember, and because it was a dark night out over the Everglades, there was no visual indication that they were getting close to land. Something there you just said, it just reminded me of like I said, the controlled flight where you don't really notice it, and then it's too late, and then gosh, what's that feeling like? Of just sheer terror.
I mean, and that's similar, I think, to what happened to JFK Jr. too, who was, I think, spiraling down until it wasn't terrain. He hit water, but it's the same thing.
Heavy fog. He was not instrument rated. And people can think of Frederick Valentich. People saying, well, you could be totally upside down and not know it. Like, well, the blood rushes to your head. I think you feel that.
Yeah.
Unless you're in maybe if you're trying to do a loop, then you don't know with the
centrifugal
force. You're
not sure when you've come back around.
Right. Maybe. You don't know when you come back around, but I think you could definitely be at a steep angle of attack there heading downward and not really notice it until it's too late. So, anyway, this was about noon and an hour into or just after takeoff when the last radio contact with the crew was made around 12:49 p.m. 1 minute later, the plane hit the hill at Saddleworth Moor at an altitude of around 1,350 feet, and they were only 20 feet from clearing the summit. Oof, almost made it.
Yeah.
And that's when the aircraft hit. It broke apart. It caught fire. And there were 29 passengers and 3 to 4 crew members on board. 21 of the passengers and all the crew members lost their lives, including 4 children. Only 8 people survived. The injured were taken to Oldham Infirmary, but getting to them wasn't easy. That also speaks to the ruggedness of this terrain.
There were 29 passengers and 3 to 4 crew members on board. It's interesting, if you look at the research, there are some sources that say there were 3 crew members and some that say 4, so that's why we're saying 3 to 4. But all of the crew died. 21 of the passengers died as well, and among the passengers, there were 4 children, too. Only 8 people survived. The injured were taken to Oldham Infirmary, but getting to them wasn't easy.
Right. We were saying that kind of owes to how rugged that terrain can be.
Yes.
You know, the weather was awful again. And that, of course, makes the rescue efforts incredibly difficult. So workers from a paper mill nearby, and this is about 3/4 mile away, they came out to help and actually formed a human chain to carry the survivors down the hillside to safer ground. Dr. John Loftus, who arrived at the scene, said it was the worst thing he'd ever seen, and he'd served in both world wars. According to the Greensburg Daily Tribune, from an article the day it happened in 1949, he stated, quote, "I found bodies scattered all over the place. There were a few survivors lying around groaning on the hillside, but some of them died before I could attend to them. I have been a doctor since 1914 and served in both wars, but this is the worst sight that I've ever seen. End quote.
The cause of the crash was found to be human error, errors in navigation, the wrong approach procedure, and failure to accurately check the aircraft's position before descending. It's really heartbreaking to think about. One of the survivors was a 5-year-old boy named Stephen Evans. He made it out along with his parents, but his younger brother, Roger, didn't survive.
Well, Stephen Evans grew up to become a well-known professor in epidemiology. In 2016, for the first time since the crash, he returned to the site with his family.
Yes. So this is interesting. This journalist, Trevor Baxter, wrote about this for the Saddleworth Independent in July of that year, 2016. Here's an excerpt from that article. The last remaining survivor of the 1949 Saddleworth Moor plane crash disaster, Professor Stephen Evans, has returned to the scene of the tragedy that claimed the life of his younger brother Roger for the first time. Professor Evans, who was only 5 when a Douglas DC-3 Dakota, en route from Belfast to Manchester, plowed into Wimberry Stones, killing a total of 24 passengers. He made the visit with sons Matthew and David and 8-year-old granddaughter Katie. In appalling weather conditions, eerily similar to the fateful August day when the plane came down, they climbed through mist and low cloud to the skyline close to Indian's Head, or Wimberry Stones. And near to the wreckage site, they allowed the Southampton-based professor of pharmacoepidemiology a few moments on his own to reflect on the life-changing events of that day nearly 67 years ago. That was as of that visit, obviously. Mm-hmm. As of today, it's 75 years ago. I had always talked about coming up here one day, but assumed I would be doing it on my own, he told The Independent. I wanted to come here and remember what I do remember of those days. It wasn't a forbidden subject, but we didn't talk a great deal about it. However, various people said I shouldn't do it on my own, I imagine for the emotional consequences of it. But actually, the physical ones are quite considerable as well. Yeah. It was quite a tough climb, especially in poor weather conditions, which again goes back to what our body on the moor, what Neil Dovestone might have gone through. The article closes with this. It was the discovery of an elderly man's body, now dubbed Neil Dovestone, on Chew Track last December that began a change of events leading to Professor Evans' return. Professor Evans theorized that maybe Dovestone was either one of the survivors of the crash or somehow connected to him. So we'll obviously address that theory in part two, but it's stories like these that remind you how much history is tied to places like Saddleworth Moor. There's so much out there, and while this crash is part of the past, it left an impact on those who survived and on the land itself. This incident was the closest one to where Neil Dovestone was found, according to our research or my map research, because I know people that have listened a long time know I get to be map nerdy about this. I've always got, when we're going through and trying to dig stuff up, I'm running Google Earth over on another page, and I'm looking at all these places, and I've actually put pins down. And I think based on where the record reflects that the plane crashed and where Dovestone's body was found, it's a little over a mile away. The other incidents that we're talking about tonight, they're all further than this one. So that's the thing that he was closest to in terms of the Saddleworth Moor history.
I'm Heather Marie Adkins, and you're listening to Astonishing Legends with Scott Philbrook and Forrest Burgess. Now back to the show.
Well, that's not all for the beautiful Saddleworth Moor, however, in what is probably the most famous and, for my money, the most gruesome, the more modern tragedy tied to it, we have what are known simply as the Moor's Murders. From 1963 to 1965, a horrific string of child murders took place in and around Greater Manchester. Ian Brady, a diagnosed psychopath, and Myra Hindley, a woman enamored with him, murdered 5 children of varying ages during that time. The victims, Pauline Reed, John Kilbride, Keith Bennett, Leslie Ann Downey, and Edward Evans, were all killed by Brady and Hindley. Pauline was 16, John and Keith were both 12, Leslie was 10, and Edward was 17. And some of the victims were sexually assaulted as well. And that's kind of what I was talking about from that BBC article about this case here when it comes down to, I think it's under the sections of the theories, but that's where Peak District National Park Ranger Andy Valentine was quoted. He makes tours of it in his 4x4. He'd grown up in that area very close by. And that's where he points out that this area where the body was found, of Neil's. It was very close to where Ian Brady and Myra Hindley buried their child victims. And he's quoted as saying, "If those trees weren't there, you would be able to see the hillside where the first bodies were found." And he also mentions the air crashes. He says, "There are 4 aircraft wrecks within less than a mile of this spot."
Yeah.
4 aircraft wrecks, which it's not like there's a lot of hills or, you know, they're trying to thread the needle here. It's just there's something about the terrain, which I think, right. And probably the weather conditions as well.
Glad had said that, you know, in addition to the DC-3, which was a passenger aircraft, that a lot of RAF flights had gone down in that area as well.
Yeah, it's just something about it. I think a combination of terrain, weather. I mean, there might be other factors that are unseen, but for some reason, it throws pilots off. It's very easy to crash here. And they certainly see a lot of crashes. But as we just said, a lot of the other misfortune as well.
Brady and Hindley actually buried 3 of their 5 victims on Saddleworth Moor. One was found in a home they shared. And then the last one, Keith Bennett, has still not been found to this day as of this recording, although he is presumed to also be buried on Saddleworth Moor.
Yeah.
The murdering couple was sentenced to life in prison and both ultimately died there.
1963, about 200 yards away from the spot, there was an avalanche killing 2 of England's best mountaineers at the time.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Not a Bermuda Triangle of tragedy, but just a lot of stuff happens here.
Between the Bill O'Jacks murders, the DC-3 crash, the Brady Hindley murders, child murders, the avalanche that took the 2 climbers, that's 33 people who were all either murdered or died in a plane crash or avalanche accident within 2.5 miles of where Neil Dovestone laid down to die. And as I said earlier, I'll post one of my trademarked Google Maps with pins that shows where most of these are that we managed to suss out for this episode. Okay. So you can see all the locations by going to the webpage for this episode at astonishinglegends.com once we get it posted. So why bring all these stories up? They're not necessarily directly related to this Neil Dovestone character or the body on the moor. And I feel like it's a little bit of a thing. We call him Neil Dovestone and people, oh, that takes the mystery away. It's like, no, people didn't know who he was. That's the John Doe of it.
Right.
But in the past with this kind of stuff, we've often talked about the idea that death is centered around certain places. And this place, you know, like you said earlier, well, I don't know if it's paranormal. Maybe it's not, but it sure is a lot of coincidence. There's a lot of things happening here, of course, with a physical outcropping and lots of air traffic coming into Manchester. Maybe that's normal for all those planes to be going down in the area. The mountains are dangerous. So, yes, we have an avalanche. It doesn't really, I don't know how you explain the child murders other than it's a remote area. So maybe that's the safest place that they felt they could successfully hide their victims. But there's a lot of activity up here in this place that is really a juxtaposition of beauty and darkness. I mean, it seems like an amazing destination to go hike and boat and do all kinds of things and biking, as the gentleman was doing that found the body on the moor. But there's also a lot of water, and we have talked about this idea that water in these high traffic areas, they attract something, but it does seem like an unusual concentration of life and death activity, which I don't know. What do you think about that, Forrest?
I think there's several areas and ways of looking at this. If you're looking at a paranormal angle, is this a place with some special properties regarding spirit and ghost hunting? Or the Fae, or anything kind of magical, or, you know, a thinly veiled place. Well, none of the articles that we came across look at it from that angle yet. We may get into that later. But in this case, well, you know what I'm saying? It's like, depending what you're going to go look for. Right now, this is more of a true crime angle that we're on.
Yeah.
So in that regard, these are just strange, odd facts and coincidences that have happened. And in that regard, that's a lower barrier, I say, to like how many of these weird coincidences have to happen before people start looking at it or looking at it in a different light who were previously of a mindset that nothing unusual or unexplainable happens. It's just maybe beyond our reach or beyond our data set at this point. It's kind of like the Bermuda Triangle. A lot of people will claim like, no, there's something that's at least geomagnetic strangely happening here. That can't be denied. Why are all these happening? And then, you just see a plethora of articles recently in the last few years, like, no, there's nothing strange about it. It's just coincidence. And it just happens to be in this area. And there's really, you know, those ships are going to go down anyway, kind of a thing. Ships go down all the time. They're just going to happen. Right. It just happens here. People focus on it. Next thing you know, we as humans like to make connections and correlations. And that's what we do. And we find what we're looking for. where you specifically go to look for weirdness, you find it in the Bermuda Triangle.
Right. It's the psychological pareidolia.
Yeah, something like that. And where you're just statistically not important at all, not significant. And so you have to look at all the moors in the UK, Scotland, Ireland.
There's England. A reason that Sir Arthur Conan Doyle was writing about them. They're intriguing right. places. They're magical, unusual places.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. He was more of a bent towards that kind of metaphysical spookiness, I think.
Yes.
Of course, you know, people bag on him for his belief in the fairy photos. And
right. You know, yes. Stuff, yes. He's been vilified for that, especially lately. I feel like just in the past couple of years, that's become a big deal.
Well, it's a reason to throw out all of his works. Just throw out that baby with that bathwater. But look, he's an artist. So, of course, he's going to look at it that way. And I do believe that a statistician could make some charts and graphs to show you like, well, it's not all that unusual. But look, that's not any fun. You want to go there and feel a vibe. Or not feel it, depending if you want to just have a nice day of hiking. I think there is something possibly to this, but I don't see the other correlations of like what we were talking about before. Again, if you look at the connections between Atchison, Kansas, the birthplace of Amelia Earhart, and the Sally House, it's like, okay, what's the connection there? Well, really nothing other than if you talk to people who work at Amelia's old birthplace home, they say, yeah, it's haunted. Like, close up at night and there's no one in here. I've double checked it and I hear footsteps coming down the stairs, these phantom footsteps. And people have seen other things like, yeah, it's an old house. It's going to have that. Is that connected to the Sally House in any way? Well, we didn't ever come up with any kind of connection there, but it's just an old town with old houses. Stuff's going to happen. There's going to be stories.
You know,
I would bet that these places have a tremendous amount of EVPs to usher forth. The pub and this area, if you wanted to go do some paranormal investigation.
And maybe somebody's done that. We didn't dig on that at all, but I think it would be pretty amazing and frightening to go spend the night in what's left of the foundation of the cellar for the Bill O'Jack's pub or the Moorcock pub. Spend the night there, take some gear. And see if you get anything, because that's a sudden horrific death. And it seems hard to imagine that you wouldn't get something there, but maybe not. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's other questions that raises is that, some stuff had happened there. I'm sure. You have to go past 1832 into the ancient history of the place. And, the indigenous Britons and anything that was happening there and even past that into spirits of the land. And then you have spirits of the ancient peoples. And then you have the 19th century. And then now you have the 20th century and all these things that have happened and piled up. We have no idea about the ancient happenings in the past to maybe lay some groundwork for something like that. But then you ask the question, it's like, talking about people taking their own lives and a vibe, they say Aokigahara Forest in Japan, where people go to commit suicide.
Yes.
There's definitely a real heavy spookiness there. And is that because the people who are in that deep, dark place are attracted to that place and want to go there to do that? Or has all of their actions cumulatively caused this spookiness and all of their ghosts are piling up and all the sorrow and misery? So again, that doesn't matter. I think wondering what the chicken and the egg here thing, but other than that, this place, I do believe that there are spots on the earth that do attract more heavy vibiness than others. And this may be one of them.
Well, and you wonder like that, if there is some sort of cumulative effect, you know, again, this is full fringe here,
sure.
And we admit that, and we'll talk about the mundane as well, especially when we get to part two, but like, if there is some sort of cumulative effect that comes with a lot of things happening at a locale, if somehow, as Russell Targ would say, or whoever it was that talks about how things stand out in the psychic space,
it's a place that has
a lot of deaths.
Yeah,
Pat Price, who's a remote viewer. When we talk about our reality not being what we think it is, you know, you have to wonder if like, wow, this is something that would stand out. And which brings me to my next question. It's like, what drove Neil Dovestone, whatever his real name is, to go to this area, because we don't know, right? So if he was meeting someone or there was a rendezvous of some kind that led to his untimely death or that he was poisoned or murdered somehow, why would that be the meeting place? If it was a suicide, why would that be the place for the suicide? And I think it's interesting that Professor Evans, who was 5 years old when the DC-3 crashed and he survived that crash, but his brother didn't, he and his parents survived, that the thing that made him go back up there was wondering if Neil Dovestone was somehow connected to the crash, which is something we'll talk about in part two.
Yeah.
Or what other things might he have been connected to? Because the other thing in the bigger picture, and I thought about this as we were looking at all these stories, was that not only has there been death there, a high number of the deaths have been children. And is that somehow a connection to look back at this horrible place where these kids died in the plane crash? These kids were murder victims. Mm-hmm. One is still buried up there somewhere. Could any of these things have motivated this guy to go to Greenfield and hike up the mountain and commit suicide?
The three big questions here, there's a in varying degrees of weight. There's the where, okay, why this spot? And then there's the who. First, that's why the police want to find this out. Like, who is this guy? And then perhaps not as importantly, but the why. Like, why there? What were you thinking? What was going through your head? Like, why did you do this? Why?
He made great effort to get there, too. Yeah, I mean, we know, we'll find out more about it again in part two, but we at least know from tonight's episode, he took a couple of trains, he rode way out into the country, he then hiked, then he got this mysterious ride somehow to the pub, and then from the pub, he hiked up the mountain. This was a pilgrimage for him.
Yeah, there may have been a plane flight involved, but why come all this way? And what was apparent from looking at his actions on CCTV in the town there is, you know, that he didn't know his way around London. He had to ask directions a few times from a bunch of different people, but he had knowledge of perhaps where he wanted to go, but not familiar knowledge on either how to get there or what would be there when he found it. But obviously he had a purpose in getting there. It seemed to me that it wasn't that aimless, although his actions during the trip were him just kind of after the train stop. There's 59 minutes that are unaccounted for, really, that we don't know what he did. He was just kind of lolling about, which I've done too, on a layover. He's not panicked. He doesn't seem worried as they see him on camera. But obviously, he is compelled in some way that there's a purpose here to either go to this spot or go to see someone as a rendezvous there.
Yeah.
The randomness is not just like, let me throw a dart and see where I end up on the train system, on the metro. He seemed purposeful in that. Why did he buy a round trip ticket? Well, as we said before, the one way was just a dollar less. So what?
Right.
He may have done some things that didn't make sense, and it's fruitless to try and find sense in them. As our friend Glad said, people do a lot of strange things when that deep, dark place, if that's where he's going. Or in a certain state of mind, you do things that are irrational that people don't understand, then we're trying to place every bit of ration on everything he did. Well, that doesn't make sense. Well, maybe he didn't do it to make sense. He just did it.
Yeah.
As they say, a lot of people who go to do such a thing, they leave stuff at home. They don't take their wallet or phone. They're not going to need them anymore. They may not go to any trouble to really erase their identity, but they do just enough that they're not easily identified. And so we may never, ever really know what was in his mind, even if you were really close to him. But we could do the best we can patching clues together. And so what do you have as far as any kind of speculation here at the end of part one, owing to the clues that we've come across so far?
I do have some ideas, but I'm going to save them for part two.
Okay.
I think it's a very interesting story. However, I just want to remind everyone who enjoys the mystery of our shows not to look this one up. Wait just 1 week for part two. We'll be back in 1 week. Before you do that, you'll have more fun. Trust us. Forrest, what are your closing thoughts?
Well, you just heard me recently, just tonight's episode. As we go along, it's brought up a lot of feelings and memories of our past shows and cases we've covered. The Great Mull Air Mystery, and a key point of that mystery is the way the body was found and how that was simply summed up by some and others. It was even added to the strange mystery of it. You know, Somerton Man, that was a long time ago when we covered that, but there's a lot of differences because this happened less than a decade ago, and there are many living eyewitnesses as well as you said, digital technology. We have better forensics, of course, to help us get to the bottom of this case. The Somerton Man case is now considered by many to be mystery solved. And in an unusual twist, so is this one. Because eventually, local authorities figured out who Neil Dovestone really was. But you know how we feel about the phrase mystery solved, don't you? Like the Somerton Man, this story is so much more complicated than simply figuring out who the body on the moor was. And we'll save that for part two.
That's going to wrap up episode 289 of Astonishing Legends. We're still on our summer schedule, which means we'll be back next week with part two. After that, we'll be switching back to our regular bi-weekly schedule until next summer.
Find and subscribe to the other shows from the Astonishing Legends Network, The Midnight Library, Scared All the Time, and Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf. We have links to all of them in our show notes. Our show is edited by Sarah Voorhees-Wendell at VW Sound and co-produced by Tess Feifel, who is also head of research and the social media manager. Our technical producer is Ed Vacola, or as we call him, the mechanic. Special thanks to our announcer, John Bolin.
My name is Rhiannon.
Hi, I'm Darren Young, and I give permission to Astonishing Legends to use my voice.
I understand this is with no implied promise of present or future compensation. Bear, B-A-I-R. Hi. Hi.
Y-O-U-N-G.
Our theme, which is available as a ringtone, was composed by Judson Crane at foundermusic.com. All other music and sound design for the show is composed and created by Alan Carestia.
Our logo was created by Tommy Beaver Design, and our animated graphics for social media and YouTube are done by Joshua Sloan at deadstreetproductions.com.
Many episodes have transcripts available. For ones that don't, you can request them by emailing transcripts@astonishinglegends.com.
Astonishing Legends would not be possible without you, our listeners. Visit our store at astonishinglegends.com. Or interact with us and other listeners on Instagram, Twitter, Discord, Facebook, and YouTube.
You can also visit us at patreon.com/astonishinglegends, where patrons have access to commercial-free versions of the show and additional bonus content, including the Patreon-exclusive show, The Astonishing Junk Drawer. If you're new to Patreon, you can save money by signing up on the web through a browser or using an Android device rather than Apple's App Store, where Apple is now charging a 30% markup on signups through iOS. No part of this show may be reproduced anywhere without permission. Copyright Astonishing Legends Productions.
Good night.